When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is the Music Buzz Podcast. The Music Buzz Podcast features candid discussions with and about those behind the scenes in the music business, including industry veterans representing the segments of musician, design, and live. All three Music Buzz podcast hosts have spent their careers working with the biggest names in entertainment and have been and are still a fly on the wall. Dane Clark as the drummer for John Mellencamp's band for over 20 years and various solo projects. Hugh Syme, a world-renowned graphic artist for the biggest names in music and the corporate world. Andy Wilson, an award-winning marketing and public relations executive with over 20 years of combined multi-level entertainment industry experience in the music and sports business. Now let's buzz.
Hello and welcome back to the Music Buzz Podcast. I'm one of your co-hosts, Andy Wilson, along with Dane Clark. Hey, Dane.
Hi, Andy.
And also Hugh Syme. Hey, Hugh.
Hey, Andrew.
Good to see you guys as always. Our guest today is American guitarist, songwriter, and record producer, Steve Cropper, known as the guitarist of Stax Records House Band and Booker T and the MGs, which backed artists such as Otis Redding, Sam and Dave, Carl Thomas, Rufus Thomas, Johnny Taylor, and many, many more. He also acted as the producer of many of these records. He was later a member of the Blues Brothers Band, and Rolling Stone magazine marked him as the 36th on its list of 100 greatest guitarists of all time. He's won 2 Grammy Awards and been nominated for 7. So welcome to the Music Buzz, Steve Cropper. Thanks for joining us today.
I need to meet that guy sometime.
Yeah, he sounds really impressive.
Somebody's done a lot of stuff.
Man, it's an honor, Steve, to have you on here today. I want to go back in history for a second, because to me, Booker T and the MGs are the quintessential American band of the 60s. Whether playing on your own records or any of the great artists recording at Stax, you guys always put the song first. Every arrangement was focused. The grooves were soul deep. Every player's part fit seamlessly, and it all sounded effortless and totally natural. And of course, having the great Al Jackson Jr. playing drums,
he made himself play real good.
Yeah, I was going to say that didn't hurt anything. We all try to learn as we get older, less is more, which is hard when you're a youngster. But man, I want to know how the band originally came together. How did you guys get that groove? It seemed so natural.
I saw Booker when he was about 14 or 15 playing in a club. And a club owner told us, you stand at the top of the steps and watch. We had to see Booker through a mirror. He said, if you see the cops, y'all get out of here because I lose my liquor license.
Wow.
And the band on stage, they just thought Booker always looked older. So it was cool. I did too, but it didn't matter. I have no idea how we formed it. I guess Jim just handpicked guys that he knew could play. And that's what happened. And it took us forever to get Al Jackson because he wasn't going to lose his night gig with Willie Mitchell. And So Jim finally said, Al, you keep your night gig as long as you play sessions for us. Well, he would record Al Green about 7 or 8 in the morning. He'd go home, wash up, and then go back to the studio with Al. And I'd have to wake him up. So Al's wife would say, you're going to have to come wake him up because he comes up fighting with me. And I poke him with a broom a little bit. I said, Al, we got a session at 11 o'clock. He just got in bed about an hour before that.
Ooh,
yeah.
That's tough. When you're a youngster, you can kind of get by with that.
Yeah,
for a while,
you don't care. And he'd been playing since he was 5 years old in his daddy's band, jazz band. So he knew a little bit of music too.
Well, those early records, all those records you guys did. I was going back through, and I used to use Booker T and the MGs as an example when I was a college professor before I joined Mellencamp for about 10 years. I worked with the jazz band, and these guys weren't listening to each other. And I said, I play Green Onions, and I say, I want you to listen to something here. I just listen. Less is more. Listen to these guys. They're playing with each other. They're listening. You know, it separates the men from the boys to be able to do that. And you guys sure did it.
I broke the record on the radio, WLOK, and Reuben Washington was a disc jockey. And I used to drop my first wife off. She was working for Sealy Posturepedic Mattresses. And I always come by the studio because the Reuben Washington was on drive time. And I said, play this. It's something we cut yesterday. And he played. He said, what's... He backed it up. I said, you don't like it? He said, no, I love it. What I didn't know, he put it out on the air when he backed it up. And the phone started like, he said, he was answering the phone, said, I don't know, we're going to find out. And he'd hang up and it'd ring again. I don't know, we're going to find out. And he did that for 3 minutes, I guess.
Intentionally?
Well, when I got to the record shop, Miss Axton, Jim's sister, said, there's something going on crazy. I bet you had something to do with it. I said, you're not talking about this, are you? So I held up the demo. We didn't even have a name for it. We didn't have one until that afternoon.
Wow.
So it was just an acetate that you guys had at that point. Yeah. Okay.
We call them dubs, but anyway, an acetate. Yeah, sure. It's all of us.
Yeah.
No title or anything. It's something we cut on a Sunday. So we cut Bruce Lee first, the flip side, the Behave Yourself flip side. And Al Jackson named that. And so Jim said, come in, listen, guys. We didn't even know he recorded it. Because we were there to record somebody else. As far as we knew, he never showed up. Mrs. Axton said he showed up at the record shop. But he couldn't sing. It was Sunday. He'd been singing all night long on Saturday night. So we were in the set up session. So Jim told Booker, I think. He didn't tell me, but he told Booker. He said, can you guys come in Sunday? Because anything Jim said, we just automatically do it. He said, I need to cut a little dub on this guy or demo on this guy. That's the rest of history. So we were cutting the blues thing. It was just a filler song. Something we'd do on stage just to mark time, just to keep time, you know. That's all. And so Jim said, if we decide to put something like that out, have you guys got anything else that you can put on the flip side? And we looked at each other, kind of starstruck, and said, no, we don't have anything. And I got to think about an hour later, a little bit. I said, Booker, you played me a couple of songs last week or 2 weeks ago that might be good for vocal. Do you remember what they were? And he said, I don't know, come down to the organ and play it. And he played Green Onions. I said, that's the one. So we cut it. Third take was the record. So Jim says, Jim made one decision. Jim Stewart, he was the engineer on a record. He made one decision. He said, Steve, the thing you're doing in the middle, put that on the intro. And when it comes time to the middle, your eight bars in the middle, just play a solo. So you heard the solo first. And listen to it again. You don't think about it now, but I'm going to tell you something. You're going to hear it every time you hear it.
Yeah.
I hit him so hard when I didn't turn my volume up. It stayed the same, but a single note is louder. I hit him so hard, he grabbed monitor the mic and just turned it down and then he eased it back up and it had gone too far.
So what was your amp and your guitar for that track?
Well, it's in Washington, D.C. now. It's a little Fender Harvard amp. And we used that amp for years as a PA system when I was in school for a singer. I don't know why. I didn't have an amp at the time, so I just brought, another amp. So I just brought that amp and it sounded good. So they mic, you know, in the studio, you can mic anything. And I think a lot of the early recordings of what's his name guitar, he used a pig nose. He's with the Eagles now. He's done so many great solos, but a lot of those things are done through a pig nose, which he told me about. Joe Walsh, he said, you guys hit that thing this man.
Joe Walsh, yeah.
That sounded more like Jim Horn than it did. Yeah. Joe Walsh. Jim hates anybody knocking him.
Well, tell you know, that first record that came out in 62, it had a couple other songs, and I'll tell you what. The I Got a Woman on there, man, it swings like crazy. It's greasy and funky.
Yeah.
And I tell you what, I listened to that last night. I listened to it twice. It made me want to go outside and fire off a round or two. It was like, you know, that's just
what I usually say in my live show. I said, if you're not shaking your booty in two bars, you're already dead.
Well, isn't that the truth?
Well, that's I think so anyway.
Well, that's a great one. Lonely Avenue is a beautiful one on that record, too.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
I mean, you guys hold the pocket so beautifully, you know, for Booker to wail, and then they hold it for you when it's your turn. I mean, it's just like the classic example of listening to the other guys, which probably, I mean, you probably didn't have that many takes when you did these songs, like you said.
You had to get it right the first time. There was no remake, no redos, overdubs. We didn't have it in those days. Everything had to be set, already ready to go. So a lot of times it'd take an hour to work a song. Sometimes it'd take less than that. We'd work it up, roll the tape. When everybody's got it, says, everybody have it? Yep. you'd roll a tape. And if it didn't feel right, then you roll it again. That's the way we cut records in those days.
And did the engineer have a lot to do with saying, hey, that felt great, guys?
I don't know, because Tom Dowd was the engineer on most of those album cuts. Jim Stewart cut Green Onions and some of the other things.
I read somewhere, I think maybe it's on your website, where it basically said you were part of every Stax record pretty much from 61 to 70. I mean, right. Where else did you have a house at that time, or did you just live there during those years?
You showed up and played.
My goodness.
I never did learn how to play guitar. I get accused of it all the time. I used the guitar as a tool, but I didn't. It turned out to be musical, but I didn't learn how to play guitar. Mm. I just used it because that's what we needed one on set. And so I've been asked before, how come there's only one guitar on most of those records? I said, we couldn't afford a second guitar player. That's why.
Wow. Good thing they couldn't.
I did a John Lennon session several years ago. I played it on the rock and roll album. There was four of the guitar players in the room besides me, and I couldn't believe it.
Phil Spector deal, yeah.
The one he produced.
Yeah, I remember that record. Who were the other guys playing guitar?
Well, I don't know. But Jeff Berry was on that song, on that album. And who else was there? Leon Russell. Leon said, you going to stay for a second song? I said, absolutely. He said, I'm out of here. Okay.
Because, I heard Phil Spector was like brandishing firearms and firing them off and stuff, wasn't he?
Well, he did that later, I think. So I was sick. You know, I wanted to hear the playback. So I opened the door, cracked it, and looked in there, and the needles were just stuck on one side. I said, that's too much for me. So I'm out of here.
That's how he'd like to hear it, I guess, huh?
Cut loud if you played back louder.
Well, hey, whatever works.
On an album somewhere. That's not original for me. That's on an album somewhere. I don't know who.
Okay. Came up
with that. How did you get connected with John Lennon to be on that record? Did you?
Well, the reason I play guitar sax, you don't know this. I'm going to tell you. Chips Bowman wanted to be an engineer. So he got to do both when he started his own studio. And I took his place at Stax, basically. I engineered some songs, played on some, whatever. But Chips wanted to be an engineer and a guitar player. He was a great guitar player, but he wanted to be an engineer. So when he started American Studios, he got to do both.
Worked out good for you.
It worked out real good for me.
How about co-writing Dock of the Bay with Otis Redding? One of the classic. I mean, I was talking earlier before you got on. I mean, you co-wrote In the Midnight Hour, Knock on Wood, Sitting on the Dock of the Bay. I mean, those three songs, when I was a kid, I didn't even know any soul music. I just listened to rock and whatever. And every band I played in played those three songs. Every band. So tell us about your songwriting with these guys and how long did that take and how did it come about and all that stuff?
Just different things. Some are immediately in the studio and some are at home and, you know, some
songs are
one another. Still the same process today.
How about Dock of the Bay?
Well, I think Otis had most of it already written. And he did something that day that he's never done in his life. He never did it. Flew up from Macon, Georgia in his private plane and went to a telephone and called me. He said, I'm just checking to see if you're at the studio. He said, I've got a hit. I'm coming right down. Now hang up. That's it. So he walked in. I said, man, that is a hit. He played it for me. And I said, but Otis, if a ship takes a water, it's going to sink. He wouldn't talk about ships. So I got to thinking a few years ago, I went, wait a minute. He was on the backside of the mountain. He couldn't have seen the Golden Gate Bridge and a sailboat going. And I always thought it was about the Golden Gate Bridge. It wasn't. It was about ferries that came over from Oakland, South Salute. So they push up a big wake when they park to let cars off. And they push up a wake on the other side when they let cars and people on. So it's the same thing. They back out of there. And that's what it said. I watch the ships roll in and I watch them roll away again. So that line, I left my home in Georgia. And I just found out recently that Don Covey, I said, you know what made that song hit? I can't do what 10 people tell me to do. They said Don Covey came up with that line. And I know he always said he wrote that song, but I don't think I know he didn't write the song. I wrote the song, but he wrote that line. That was a good one. And it doesn't run. I can't do what 10 people tell me to do, so I guess I'll remain the same. It's in there. It's the same rhyme. That's the way Otis did it. So it turned out real good.
Yeah, it turned out fairly good. All major chords, too, right, if I remember correctly.
Well, most of Otis's songs were all major if we wrote. In other words, minors would be major because he was just a one-finger guy, up and down. So unless the song already was written, and had minors, he didn't play guitar on that one. I did. So I'd have to get the other. I had two guitars at the time. one tuned to a chord and one tuned to a regular standard. And I called that Vassapoo for years and I found out it wasn't Vassapoo at all. It was a different tuning for Vassapoo. I always thought it was open tuning to E. I don't know what it is. It's either G or D or something. It was an open tuning for Vassapoo.
So that was an open tuning that when you guys were putting that together that day that you were...
Yeah, the, all those licks were done open tuning.
Oh, cool.
That's I didn't use regular tuning to play those licks. I do now on stage, but I played them just bar chords.
How about In the Midnight Hour? Take us back to that.
Well, you know, I tell a story on when I'm live. I'll start with Midnight Hour. And then knock on wood, I did this. Is a true story here. So 84, we knew we had a hit. He wanted to write a song about his girlfriend's phone number, which didn't work at all. I'm talking about 6345789.
Oh, yeah.
Right. I grabbed a pencil, piece of paper off the nightstand in the room we were in Lorraine Motel, and sat in the corner like a dunce until I got him to go up, down, 6345789. That's my number. And Eddie's, you know, when you write a song in a motel room, you want to be real quiet. If you don't, you're going to get thrown out. So when we get to the studio with it, Eddie said he couldn't sing. It was too high for him. And Al Jackson, of all people, said, you're going to sing this in a key you guys wrote it in. And he's straining in a little bit, but on that record, but he's not now. He just hits it like a normal deal. He can't even say his name 5 minutes before we go on. I said, Eddie, I've got to know something. How do you do that? He said, I just blow it out on the first song and I forget about it. But knock on wood, I didn't finish the story on Knock on Wood. It's the intro of Midnight Hour backwards. It's the same thing. It
really?
Starts on D. The Midnight Hour starts on the D and walks down. D, B, A, G.
Yeah. Right.
So Knock on Wood goes E, G, A, B, D.
Oh, it sure does.
Takes a call right on the A. And Knock on Wood, what makes it different is it's a bridge change. I don't want to lose, which is an A. That's a bridge change. This good thing that I got, if I back to E, I would surely lose it a lot, because your love is better than any love I know. It's like lightning and thunder. So we're doing, Eddie and I are doing an interview. I forgot about this. He said, if you remember, it really stormed crazy. He said, that's where the lightning and thunder came in.
I got a song to ask you about. And the song, The Hunter, Albert King's song, which was, you know, recorded by Ike and Tina and Free and Blue Cheer and a bunch of others. Can you talk about that song?
Sure. Carl Wells, an older guy, came up with that idea, and I said, that's a great idea for a song. The reason there's so many writers on that song is because they did write it in the studio. That song was written in the studio with the band. But all I had was they called me the Hunter, and we were doing Albert King. And that's what he's saying. And I think Tina did a cover of it, had a big record.
Yeah, the version that Free recorded, I think, is amazing.
Yeah, it's really good, too, yeah.
Really, thank you.
I really enjoyed what you did with Dave Mason.
That was a fun tour. That's all I can tell you. That was great fun. I didn't know he was that good, but he is. He's a great guitar player. Fantastic guitar player. He sings pretty good too. I only know the song Only You Know and I Know, and the other one on it. We both disagree that one. He didn't write. That's the only song we did that he didn't write. I didn't know that. I thought he wrote it. Everybody did. Bill Withers wrote Use Me, but it didn't. There was another one. So the record company said, Bill, you got to cut this song. Same thing with Dave. And he did the biggest record I ever had, I guess.
Low Spark and Watchtower were really good. I love the way they...
Well, he told me that he played acoustic guitar on the original cut of that.
Yeah, he did. He did play acoustic guitar.
He played acoustic guitar, not electric.
And supposedly Brian Jones was on there, but they couldn't use any of this stuff he did because he was too wasted. He was at that session too, supposedly. You know, I've been in John Mellencamp's band since 96, and you produced Nothing Matters and What If It Did.
Right. Ain't Even Done With A Knife was a big hit out of that one. And I produced Coco, if you don't know. And that's what Richie had just broke up with his wife, so everything he wrote was a tearjerker song. Richie's great, so talented. So Clive called me from New York. He said, how's it going with Poco? I said, well, Richie's writing all this song. So we came up with Railroad Days. That was by somebody else. So Paul Cotton wrote the song and was in the band. He took Jim Messina's place.
Yep, Paul Cotton's a good player. So Mike Wunschick, the guitar player for John, who's still in the band, who was at those sessions. He told me he's got a remembrance of those sessions. And here's what he said. I thought this would be funny to share. So there was a song called Hot Night in the Cold Town on that record, that Mellencamp record. And he played the solo on it, and he thought it was cool. And you said, wait a minute, it's not worth shit if you can't raise your shoulders and clap your hands at the same time. And right. he said, I definitely learned the lesson of minimalist playing for maximum benefit and the power of the backbeat. I thought that was fabulous, man. What a great lesson. And, you know, Mike's a great rhythm guitar player. I've been playing with him for 28 years now. So thank you for that lesson, man. He's right in the pocket. Thanks to you.
So we were doing a Meriwether Post Pavilion up in Baltimore thing. And so I get a call from Susan. And it says, somebody from Cherokee in L.A. is on the phone for you. And it was Susan. And she was D's wife, D. Rob's wife at the time. She said, guess who's in the studio in the back? I said, who's that? John Mellencamp. I said, get out of here. John Cougar in those days. But he took the Cougar out later. But anyway, he turns in an album and the record company turned it down. Then he cuts American Fool. Hello. How big is that one? That made his career right there. That made anybody's career. That would have made my career had I produced it, but I didn't.
Wow. There were some great songs on that record that you did produce, that's for sure.
Yep, sure were.
So can you tell us a little bit about the reissue of your first solo record, right, with a little help from my friends?
Problem with that album is very simple. There's people on that album that should be listed, but they're not. So I told Al Bell, you'd never get another one. Leon Russell's on that album. Buddy Miles is on that album. Delaney Bramler's on that album. Paul Riddle's on that album. Not the whole album, but they're on different songs at different times. And the Barcades and the MGs. And so Duck played some, Knucklehead played Nuck. James Alexander is his real name. We call him Nuck, Knucklehead. Short for Knucklehead. So they named him, I didn't.
And so Buddy Miles, how many tunes was he on?
Two. Rattlesnake and what's the other one? I'd have to look at the album in front of me. I was supposed to know all that stuff and I can't remember everything. I'm too old to remember everything. But I remember a lot.
Who's playing Funky Broadway?
That's the Barcade.
Because that's killer. It is funky, man. Strut that funk on that thing.
And you know the one I like is did it? Is it what is it? Curtis Mayfield wrote it about a drug dealer. It was a big hit for them, and then we had it. I don't think any hits come out of that album, even with a little help from my friends.
Well, that's
so
a great
first thing is done with the Herzog.
With a little help from my friends, the way you guys did it was great. Kind of based on more like the Cocker version than the Beatles version, obviously. Right. But it's a beautiful version of that. Who's playing drums on that?
Huh?
Who's playing drums on that? Do you remember?
Probably Al Jackson, I guess.
I kind of thought it was maybe Al.
Yeah.
That's his kind of slow.
So that album is being re-released, so it'll have all the credits on it this time.
Right. And it looks like a bunch of bonus songs too, right? Bonus songs and different versions of songs. It's got the original 11 tunes, and then it's got another, looks like 8 songs on the previously unreleased stuff. So that's cool.
Yeah. How'd you like working with Steve Winwood?
He's great. He turned out to be a good friend too, so that's good.
That's good, man. Yeah. I admire him. He's a great player and great.
You know, he still has a house, not walking distance, but driving distance, about a mile and a quarter from this house where I'm coming to you from.
You have your driver, right? Take you there.
Yeah, I wish. My wife takes
you. You got your own hairdresser and makeup. I mean, come on. we saw her.
Whose daughter is that? I don't know. I had nothing to do with it. Yeah, right. If you saw my wife, you'd know where she came from.
So how did the whole Blues Brothers band thing come about? Like, where did that come from for you guys?
That's a weird one. Well, John called me, and the thing was that I had to deal with all worked out with a friend of mine, publisher. And if he called and said he was a little Stevie Wonder or the president or something like that, I knew who was calling. So they called us, they said, John Belushi, and I hung up on John Belushi. Second time I hung up on him. Third time he called us, said, Steve, don't hang up, it really is John Belushi. So that is a true story. He said, how soon can you be up here? I said, well, when I get through mixing this, it'd be about a week. He said, no, I got to have you sooner than that. And I said, okay. So I said, hang on a second. So I asked Bruce if he could mix 2 or 3 of the songs after we got this other one mixed. And we were working on Robin Ford, I think, at the time. And From the Inside, Robin Ford. And
oh, yeah, that's a great record.
Yeah, not bad.
Damn good. He's a ridiculous, ridiculous guitar player.
He used that instead of the word butt from time to time. So that's awesome. And Bruce said, yeah, I can do it. No problem. But it's because they did that for Jerry Wexler one time. And he was telling me the story. And I said, can you do the same thing? What Jerry did, he had left and right in a phone. He had two phones at Atlantic. And he listened to the left side and the right side at the same time. So he got the stereo. I said, just send me the mono. I just want to hear how the mix turns out. Because it's all going to go to mono anyway when it comes on the radio. And because right. Nobody had playback systems in those days that was any good. And so I punched Ronnie Capone, who engineered a lot of that stuff at SAC. I said, Ronnie, how many people do you know have a $400,000 sound system? He said, I don't know anybody that does. I said, good, turn that crap off. So we called my engineer. I said, you know, we've got four track in the car with a little 2.5-inch speaker. And I said, that's what kids are listening to. And then he got the bass all turned up. And I said, can you make me a four-track recorder so the playback system? He said, absolutely. So we got a four-track recorder, and he turned it into a recorder, I mean, machine. So four-track playback. And we mixed a bunch of stuff. Judy Clay, we mixed on that. And that's the only one I remember. But there was a time in about 3 or 4 months we mixed everything through the little speakers. And that was bad news. The Seberg speakers were not good speakers. They were Altex, but they still weren't very good sitting on the floor. And they made those rooms sturdy so girls could dance on them and not break them. So they had a bunch made up for the discos, and that disco was going out at the time. So we bought one pair, one for the studio, one for me, and that was it.
The guy took over the mixes, and you took off to, where'd you meet Belushi at when you headed towards
him? Oh, that one. Well, the first time I met him was at Paul McCartney party. And Paul had him come down from New York to do that Joe Cocker thing that he did. And I tell you a little story about that one. Joe, over to Leon Rush. Leon told me this story. So I don't know if it's true or not. But anyway, he said that Joe kind of woke up out of it. He was asleep on his couch. He woke up and Saturday Night Live was on. He said, I don't remember doing that, and just crashed back out. He thought it was him. It was John Belushi.
That's great.
It was a good entertaining pretty well.
Oh, no question.
Oh, that's great,
yeah. No, he was awesome. He was so talented, it was ridiculous. That's the thing I can say about Belushi, he never refused a fan an autograph. If it was 20 of them or one of them, it didn't matter.
Yeah.
Wow. He'd stay there until everybody got their autograph and was happy, and then be on your way. And so we're Duck and I are in Bernie Brillstein's office. He was Danny and Belushi's manager. He said, I spend more time trying to make up with people what John has given them the night before than I do manager, either one of them. They were generating so much money per day, it was ridiculous.
Well, what a classic movie. I've watched it so many times.
I didn't know it was going to live that long. Nobody else did either. And I said, John, how come we're doing a second movie in Canada? He said, we saved $18 million the day we said, okay, and signed a contract to do the movie up there. The first movie, I think, I forget how many weeks we were in Chicago, 21 to 25 weeks in Hollywood, and about 15 or so weeks in Chicago. That's what it was. It was imbalanced. And because I lived in L.A., I didn't get any per diem.
Come on now.
I paid well enough in the movie. It didn't matter. And I've had some guys, the horn players especially, call me and said, thank you for keeping records. I used to turn in all the sessions at Stax. Thank you for keeping records, because when they got paid, if they used one of the original tracks in a movie, they got paid by the scale it was then that day instead of the scale they made the record up. For $15, they were getting $207.
Nice. The scale of whatever it was right then when they were going to use it again.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's only fair.
That's history now. They're not going to play that. They might play Green Onions. That'd be about it. I heard Green Onions in an NFL commercial last Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
This Sunday.
Once. That ought to be nice. That ought to be a nice check headed your way.
It'd be a nice check.
I was going to say, that song, you're probably running out to the mailbox, what, a couple times a day every time you hear that song, right?
Well, no, just once. They call it mailbox money. And I've been getting checked out of mailbox for years, and they finally called it. They said, "Call it what it was, I guess, mailbox money." You don't need to do it. You just need to go down to your mailbox and get another check. Yeah, right.
I would have gotten a great big one. Yeah, just there it is. Just fill that bad boy up.
You're still waiting on that per diem check, though, from Blues Brothers. Right.
Yeah.
Go down there and check every day. Still not here.
That's so classic.
Second movie. They said, "This is what they're going to offer you. Take it or leave it." Our manager at the time, road manager, negotiated. He found some money that wasn't being used anywhere. So give him that money. Okay. It's about 30 grand a piece. It wasn't bad.
What year was that? Was that 1980?
On the second movie?
The first movie.
I'm trying to. Oh, the first one was came out in 78 or 79.
79, maybe. Okay.
I think Belushi died in 83. So we'd already done one big tour promoting the movie and getting ready for another one. And then he passed away. Danny and Belushi had already negotiated the road tours.
Uh-huh.
They were going to do movies. They'd still be doing them today, I guess. Like the Bob Hope and Bing Crosby, the road tour. Same kind of a thing. That's what Danny said. So I don't know. It didn't happen. Let's put it that way. And I think Belushi had just done that with Blair. I sat with her and what's his name? It is Memorial Wake or whatever it was in New York. And okay, I got one for you. Who's throwing the bottle, you know, in the Blues Brothers movie? We're ducking and ducking and ducking. Who's throwing the bottle, beer bottles at us?
Oh, at the when you guys are behind the chicken wire? When you're playing Rawhide? I don't know.
Okay, I'm going to tell you who's doing it. Then you're going to tell me why.
Okay. It's
Willie Nelson's sister's paycheck. Why were they throwing bottles at us?
Why were they?
They were next door doing coal miner's daughter, and they just came over to see what we were doing, and Landis handed them a box of beer bottles, sugar beer bottles. So the first one didn't go very hard. The second one, they started throwing them over, ducking. It took me, it's like steel wool. It takes forever to get that out of your clothes, your neck.
I'll bet. So Willie was just heaving those things, huh?
Yeah.
That's classic.
Then they turned around and shot it from the back, looking out.
Wow. That's a wonderful scene. One you can't ever, if you've seen it, which everybody in the world has, I would assume. Yeah, country and Western, right? Both kinds of music.
I was up in Chicago recently. We went out to grab dinner at the Billy Goat Tavern, which is obviously part of the, in the movie as well. So there's still some staples in and around the city.
You know, I wasn't there when they dropped that car. I wish I had been for some of the stunts. They sent us home, we didn't have any more lines. Or not anymore, no more. We didn't have any lines that week. So they sent us home, and that's when they shot that. The car falling down, they actually dropped that car from a helicopter, a real car. So I know the movie had 200 cars that crashed. I think they had 13 Bluesmobiles in that movie. So the first movie had the most car crashes of any movie in history. The second movie had the most rock and roll well-known people in it. You know, that ending scene with Bo Diddley and everybody, with Winwood, and everybody was in it.
So there's some questions we always like to ask, Steve, to different guests. So, you know, take us back to your early years before Stax, before Booker T and the MGs. Like,
well, okay, we had a little band in high school, and we're good enough. We played it. We learned all of the hits that these kids have been listening to the radio. Nobody in Memphis that we knew of could afford getting the real artists. So they got us instead. So we were playing senior proms in our junior year and also in our senior year. So the first record, the first hit we had out of that band was Last Night. So they told us we'd have to change the name of the group, which we did. They said the first name was a little suggested. And they wanted to name it the Marquise because there's a marquee out in front of Stax. I said, "We'll name it the Marquise if I can spell it." And they said, "We don't care. Just spell it any way you want to. Good. MAR-Keys, K-E-Y-S, because it's a keyboard song." And they had Mar, everybody in those days, the Marvelettes and the Mar This, the Marvels and the Martones. But there was three or four groups called the Mar This, the Mar That, so I named them the Marquees. Right. And a year later, we had Green Onion. They were still on the road, you know, battling out to Last Night. And I left them in, as soon as we finished in Shreveport, I think it was, I left them in Bossier City, not Shreveport, same area, at the Show Bar in Bossier City.
And how old were you again when Green Onions came out?
When Green Onions was to happen, 21, I guess, 22. Okay. I think 21 when we cut it, 22 by the time it came out in October. It came out in August, September, October, so 2 months before.
That's well, great. You got an encyclopedic memory there.
Not really. Ah. Something that happened 10 seconds ago, I'm not going to remember anything.
So you played with so many people, you know, over the years. Is there anybody you haven't played? That you haven't played with that you always kind of wish you could have or would
no,
like to?
No, I do get asked that similar question about, is there any artist you work with? I mean, you didn't, that you'd like to work with, that you didn't get to work with. And her number one answer would be Tina Turner. Yeah. That makes sense to me. Mm. But that's the only artist I can think of I didn't work with.
That's kind of amazing that you guys didn't work with Tina, honestly.
Yeah, I'm lucky. Hmm. And the problem is that Stax, I got paid for all those records. When I went to California, I didn't get paid for them. I got a session paid, and that's it. You remember a little song called Every Time I See Your Face, it reminds me of the places we Ringo's first album. I played on that and Step Lightly.
Hmm. Photograph is the name of that song.
I wrote, co-wrote, Tonight's the Night Gonna Be All Right. Wrote that in Rochester's Den.
Really?
With the Rod Stewart.
Yep. He had rented a house up Beverly Hills in his den, and we wrote that one.
Wow. That was a classic. That was a great record.
I had no idea you did that one. That's great.
Hmm. So this is a true story on the Ringo thing. The demo was terrible. So Richard Perry said, we'll cut it some other time. He's going to throw it off the session. I look at Nicky Hopkins. I said, Nicky, let's go out and put a groove on this thing. About that time, Skelner comes out and sits down. Then Ringo came out and sat down. Then Klaus comes out and sat down. And we cut it, and that was it.
Yeah, Nicky Hopkins, what a great player, too.
Oh, what a great player he was.
Did you ever work with George Harrison? I know he co-wrote the song with Ringo. Did you ever meet George?
But I never. We didn't talk about music. We talked about everything but music.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And the only time I ever played on stage with him was during that Bob Dylan special, I guess. We did it at the Garden.
Oh, yeah, the Madison Square Garden. That was great.
And he ended up playing behind everybody, including Johnny Cash and on and on.
Yeah.
What's the name for the fiddle player?
Yeah, that was a heck of a night, man. That, you're right. Like everybody you can think of played on that show. That was incredible.
Oh, actually, that night, well, Mellencamp opened the show, and then John Casella, the keyboard player, they flew back right after they were done, and then he came into the bar I was playing in and played keyboards all night.
Really?
The night of that show.
Basically, yeah. Oh, that's cool. Basically, on that show was the same band that played behind Neil Young in '93. So right. It was Keller, Duck, Booker, and myself.
Nice.
Who was the drummer on Neil's Harvest album? I forget.
And Tim Drummond.
We're doing that song. We're up in Detroit. Duck says, look, and the moon was just coming up. Harvest moon was just coming up. Big old moon.
Amazing.
A lot of things happen on the road. There's a lot of fun.
So I've heard.
Don't believe a word of it.
You just got to stay at home and make album covers. You're not allowed to go on the road.
Anything you hear, only half what you see, you might be able to make it through life.
Yeah, that's good advice. That's right. You gonna be playing? You got any playing coming up?
No, I got a couple of albums coming out though. One to follow up the one that got the Grammy or not got nominated for a Grammy 2 years ago. And Billy Gibbons is on it this time. That's real good.
Real good.
Same band and everything with the addition of Billy Gibbons.
Great. Who's the band? Who's the band?
Eddie Gore, my partner, and John Tiven on bass. On drums and myself, that's it. And Roger Real is singing. I call him Roger Real. It's bigger. Roger Real is tiny. And so when we're doing that, Betty LeVette of all people said, well, I used to date I'm always talking about Lovin' Palmer, the guitar player with Five Royals. She said, I know I dated his brother. He always called the band the Royals. I said, it sounds like a baseball team to me. That struck home real quick. So I never did hear them call the Royals. I always heard the Royals.
Right.
Because Dewey Phillips played the records, and they made them bigger, grander. The Five Royals. Yeah.
We'll look forward to that new record, especially with Billy on it. That's going to be incredible. Right.
So somebody asked me, going back a ways, how come the twists were so big? How come last night was so big? I said, I guess. I remember back to my mom, the first time I played the record, she started doing the twist. I said, I guess it was the first twist instrumental. Hank Battle of the Midnighters had the first one, and Chubby Checker came out with it, covered it. Then Pat Boone and the other people did the twist. That was a big dancer back in the late 50s, early 60s.
I remember.
Pat Boone. I didn't know Pat Boone did a version of it. I'm sure Pat Boone whitewashed it pretty good, like he did Tutti Frutti.
Well, if I could sing like Pat, I wouldn't. So there you go.
Well,
he's a pretty good singer. I missed the chance of meeting him, but I took Elvis instead. I thought he was getting on a plane, and the people were there interviewing him. It was Elvis that had the plane.
So who are the guys from the 50s, the like Little Richard? Did you ever get to hang out with him?
Chuck Berry, Little Richard. Chuck Berry, Little Richard, and Fats Domino.
Okay.
That was a big three.
Three of the greats.
Three of the greatest. So we grew up, I was influenced very soon at a young age. So I was in high school, I guess, 9-2. I started playing when I was about 14. Never put me in 8th or 9th grade. So all the guys at school, at Messick, and the seniors and all, and all during those years, wanted to play guitar. So there was one guy that knew how to play. He wasn't such a great guy, but he knew how to play. He's not with us anymore, so he's not here to back it up. Anyway, he taught us a lot of those things, like honky-tonk and all that. So I'm inducting Bill Doggett one night, and he wanted somebody else to play on it, which is fine. I wanted somebody else to play the bass thing. When he found out, he said, "I wish you'd told me you played on the original stuff." He said, "I'd have had you playing." But that's a keyboard song. It should have been in the key of F.
Oh, it's in the key. It's in the key of F.
So we always played in the key. We learned in the key of E. And when the horn comes, da 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 da, we'd modulate that, and that worked pretty good.
So originally, that was in the key of F.
Yeah,
that's a pain in the ass for a guitar player. Tune up a half step.
Now you know why they call it sort of the black key. So we did, we were doing Toys for Tots one time in Santa Barbara. And so they said, "We got Steve Crawford in the house. Come on up here, Crawford. Play a little Green Onions." And they had turned the piano down. And we had to stop and start over. I said, "Man, it's in F minor."
Oh, so somebody had turned the piano to a different key?
Yeah, it was whatever it was.
Oh, jeez.
Harpies or something, they tuned it down. Craig Fillinghames didn't know that until he hit it. He said, "Damn, it's in the wrong key. You've been playing the wrong key all I know. Didn't even know it."
That's funny.
He must have known it.
Well, he was a great player, Craig Fillinghames.
I worked with him a few times, but he's awesome.
Yeah, he's killing.
You failed to mention one of my favorite is "I'm a Love Man." Bye-bye. They call me the Love Man. Da-da-da. That's a good one. That's got a good groove to it.
That's a classic. There's so many. I mean, I tell all of our listeners, go back and listen to all the Booker T and the MGs records. The Soul Dressing record, "And Now." You know, I love all those early ones, especially. Just good stuff. And the one where, what's the name of the one? Well, it's the street that the studio's on. The one where you're doing the Abbey Road.
Macklemore Avenue?
Yeah. You're walking across the street like the Beatles.
I got to tell myself on that one. Booker dictated everything I was supposed to play. He said, Booker would call me in New York. He said, when can you be here? I said, as I finish this album. I was doing something for Jim Jettison. I was doing Ambergris at the time for Jim Jettison. So Booker said, when you coming? I said, I'll be there tomorrow. And he picked me up at the airport and took me straight to Wally Hyder. And dictated everything I was supposed to play that day. I never did hear that. The only thing I heard of Abbey Road was whatever they played on the radio.
Oh, so you cut that at Wally Hyder's in San Francisco?
No, they cut the tracks and stacks. I overdubbed at Wally Hyder.
I see. Okay.
Okay. There you go.
Good to know. Great.
Good to know. So, what's her name's? Higher and Higher. I'm going to take you higher. That's Paul Stallworth playing bass. And we cut that at Crossroads of the World on Sunset Boulevard with Booker. Booker turned it in. He was cutting it on his wife. And so Lou Adler said, Booker, don't be upset with me, but get that on, take your wife off of that. Had a number one record with it. So that guy knew what he was talking about. Rita and, what was Booker's wife's name? Priscilla. Rita Priscilla. So which makes Chris, he was married to one of them at one time, makes Chris and Booker brother-in-laws at one time. Yeah, the last time I saw him was at the Peabody in Memphis, but the last time I saw him in L.A., he was in a jacuzzi.
Always nice. The Peabody with the ducks walking around. That's a trip always.
There's little rubber ducks. No, I don't like them anyway.
For anybody that has Apple Music, there's a great playlist on there. It's called The Songwriters. It's Steve Cropper.
I'm going to go all the way back to the John Mellencamp. I knew I was going to have trouble. I was in Bloomfield, Indiana with them for about 2.5 weeks.
Oh, you were?
And I knew I was having trouble with their drummer. So I said, I've got to have my, after the first day of recording, I said, I've got to have my drummer, but I'm not going to send you home. You're going to sit in that couch and listen to every note he plays. How about, what's his name?
Kenny Aronoff, yeah.
Number one call drummer in the world right now.
I'm not sure that's true, but.
Well, I am. If I tell you his name, you're going to say
yeah. Well, I know it's Kenny Aronoff. He's the guy I replaced.
Kenny Aronoff, yeah. That's him.
Yeah, I
replaced him. And I'm telling that story to some people in over in Europe, in Switzerland. He said, everything Cropper just said is the truth. He said, I said, there's that guy. Huber was his name. He never could make it. He weighed about, I don't know what he weighed, 280, but he was good. He could play that backbeat at foot. Oh, man.
Who was it now?
His name was Michael Baird. We call him
I know who he is.
He made a name for himself in the studio.
Yeah, I know who Mike Baird is. He was a session guy that did a lot of records in the late 70s.
Well, thank you so much, Steve, for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Glad to do it.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more Fantasy Points.